Nobody can be too Jewish.
That's exactly it. You got it.
Shalom and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and Friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Elias Saratovsky, the Executive Director of Birthright Israel. We'll also have a visit from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. The opinions of the host and guests on Two Jewish are their own and not those of the radio station. Two Jewish is paid for by Two Jewish Radio Programs and Podcasts, Tucson, Arizona. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. This is a unique year on the calendar, and we're experiencing one aspect of it this very weekend. In fact, today, on the American calendar, this was our once in 4 years leap year, which included February 29th, a couple weeks ago. On the Hebrew calendar, the one we Jews use for calculating holidays and years, it is also a leap year, which means that we add not just one day, but an entire month. The Jewish calendar, that's the same thing as what's called the Hebrew calendar sometimes, follows the cycles of the moon, the lunar calendar. These lunar years are regular, which means you don't drop days over the course of following the lunar calendar, and your holidays fall in the correct season, if you make a certain adjustment. Well, okay, actually, it's very complicated. Now, the solar calendar, the one we use here in America, that's used in Europe and, well, frankly, nearly everywhere else around the world for most purposes, follows the cycles of the sun, which is regular, more or less, with the addition of that leap day, February 29th, every 4 years. On the solar calendar, the months, which originated with the lunar calendar, by the way, don't really follow the cycles of the moon anymore, but holidays fall in their expected seasons, global warming excepted, and while there is a tiny discrepancy that causes the solar calendar to lose a day every 3,000 years or so, the Gregorian version of the solar calendar is nonetheless pretty accurate. It must be noted that it took a very long time indeed for this Gregorian calendar to be accepted in many places. For example, since it was a decree of a Catholic pope named Gregory in 1582, it only directly affected the tiny papal states in Italy and the church itself and its institutions. Other Catholic countries, including the then giant Spanish Empire, adopted the reform of the ancient Julian calendar to the Gregorian pretty quickly. Catholic France and its growing empire followed suit shortly thereafter, still back in the 1500s. But it took Protestant countries, fearful of being taken over by the Pope, much longer to accept the Gregorian calendar reform that fixed the problems of the old one. Great Britain didn't use it in England or in its colonial empire until the 1750s. That's why George Washington's birthday changed about 2 weeks during his lifetime. Japan didn't buy in until, all the Meiji reforms and such in the 1870s. China came along in 1912 to the Gregorian calendar, and the Ottoman Empire never adopted it. It wasn't until after World War I that the countries that had remained under its authority, like Turkey itself, switched over. Russia didn't change the Gregorian calendar until the Tsar fell. Greece held out till 1923. And most remarkably, that very modern country, Saudi Arabia, did not officially adopt the Gregorian calendar until 2016. Now, for ritual purposes, that meant that those versions of Christianity that didn't move to the Gregorian calendar preserved different dates for ritual, even after the rest of things had changed in the West. That's why there are still several dates on the Christian calendar for the holiday of Easter. It's a solar calendar based on the sun that's trying to match up with the lunar calendar based on the moon and, kind of missing. Okay, so that's the sun calendar we use for civic purposes in all but a few countries in the world. but the older lunar calendar, based on the cycles of the moon, is more regular, right? Well, sort of. A purely lunar calendar, following the cycles of the moon, and even ancient peoples who lacked telescopes could observe with the naked eye by looking at the night sky and see the shape of the moon, the lunar calendar has 12 months that alternate regularly between 29 and 30 days. They follow the cycles of the moon, from new moon to full moon and back. That takes 29 or 30 days. The problem is that the year that it creates with 12 of these months is 354 days long. That means it gets out of sequence with the seasons, and months literally cycle through the year. That is the calendar still used today for Islamic religious purposes. That's why Ramadan can come any time of year, like right now, this year, for example. That means that holidays move around every year from season to season. Now, the Jewish calendar is technically a lunisolar calendar, that is, lunar combined with solar. It's similar to those used by many ancient societies, and it's still relevant for holiday observance in places like China and India, and, you know, for Easter, as we said. It works like this. In order to keep the otherwise regular lunar calendar in sync with the cycles of the seasons, and with the solar calendar, you add a month, kind of now and then. Here's how it works. Over a 19-year cycle, this lunisolar calendar is almost totally regular. It loses a day only every 32,000 years, of no great concern to most of us. Now that's amazing, pretty regular. But how it becomes so, well, that's not simple. In that 19-year cycle, there will be 7 leap years in which you add not a single day, but a whole month. That gets things back on track with the seasons. But which years add the month was calculated way back in antiquity by scholars, mostly rabbis, doing what is called intercalation. That complex process is now fixed into tables, calculated mathematically. I just look it up on hebcal.com or the calendar app on my iPhone. All of this is a long way of saying that we are in one such leap year right now on the Jewish calendar. Today we celebrate the beginning of the new month of Adar Sheni, that is the second month of Adar, the month of the holiday of Purim. You see, during a Hebrew calendar leap year, it is Adar that gets doubled. You get two of them. And the holiday that falls in Adar, Purim, is moved to the second one of those, Adar Sheni, and observed 2 weeks from last night and today. There will not be a quiz on this on Too Jewish next week, I promise, because Adar is considered to be the month of joy, particularly because spring begins in Israel now, and God knows this year they could use spring and some joy. But partly this is because of the great joyous holiday of Purim. And so to play us in this morning on this Rosh Chodesh, this beginning of the new month of Adar today, and for the upcoming holiday of Purim, when we celebrate triumphing over anti-Semites in Persia, that is Iran, here's Misha Nichnas Adar. When we enter the month of Adar, we multiply joy.
Sada, my vin simcha, vishnu.
That was Mishenichnas Adar Marbim Besimcha. When we enter the month of Adar, we multiply joy for the month of Purim. Don't miss Purim for Grownups, coming in 2 weeks at Congregation Beit Simcha, starring nationally renowned comedian Rabbi Bob Alper. It's coming up Sunday night, March 24th, 6:30 p.m. You can get your tickets at BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org. Our guest this morning on Two Jewish, Elias Saratovsky, is the executive director of Birthright Israel. That's resumed sending young Jews to Israel in its extraordinary programs. Find out how they're handling the matzav, the current situation, and much more when we come back in a moment with the director of Birthright Israel on Two Jewish. The stories we share last a lifetime and are passed down from generation to generation. Known for our compassionate commitment to the families we serve, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has faithfully served the Tucson community and the Jewish community for over 100 years. We help thousands of families plan and carry out celebrations of loved ones in unique and special ways and assist them in sharing those lifetimes of stories meaningfully. The most beautiful and tranquil final resting place in all of southern Arizona, Evergreen's tall pines shade peaceful grassy fields. You can count on Evergreen for superior service and the highest degree of integrity. Our informative, well-trained staff is here to assist you with a full range of on-site services. Call Evergreen, 520-888-7470, 520-888-7470. While we serve the whole community, our experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. We have sections dedicated to all religious faiths, can help you arrange for your future needs or your immediate ones. Whether you choose to hold a traditional funeral service or a completely individualized ceremony, either in person or online or both, our goal is to help you create a meaningful, personalized service based upon your unique needs in a place of reflection, tradition, and serenity. Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best to the community and to you. Call 520-888-7470. To speak to a family advisor at Evergreen, call 520-888-7470. We are delighted to welcome the Two Jewish, our guest this morning. Elias Saratovsky is the fairly new president of Birthright Israel, the Birthright Israel Foundation, which has done remarkable work in bringing young Jews to Israel to connect in a way that wasn't possible before Birthright existed. Elias Saratovsky had a long career at AIPAC, where he had a number of highly responsible positions with the America-Israel PAC, and has been working in the Jewish institutional world for most of his career. Good morning and welcome to Two Jewish.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I'm honored to be here.
So you are actually a Birthright alum, right?
That's right. My passion and my love for the Jewish state and for the Jewish people began on my Birthright trip in December 1999.
Tell us how Jewish you were before that, just for the heck of it.
Well, my parents immigrated to the United States shortly before I was born from the former Soviet Union. And like a lot of Soviet Jews that came to America and then came to Israel, they knew that they were Jewish. They were fairly proud to be Jewish, but had no concept of what that meant in a formal sense. So growing up, I very rarely went to synagogue. I didn't have a lot of those rites of passage that a lot of young Jews have. I didn't go to Jewish summer camp. I had a bar mitzvah in Israel, where really my love for Israel began. But I don't even remember having a Seder growing up. I don't think I went to a Passover Seder until I went to college. So I had that knowledge that I was Jewish, but I didn't really know what being part of the Jewish people meant until I went to Israel and I was surrounded by thousands of other young Jews that were there in Israel on their first Birthright trip. And that's really where my feeling of responsibility for the Jewish people and really my knowledge of being Jewish came from.
You know, it's fascinating. I think, like a lot of American Jews most American Jews don't realize how little Jewish background Jews from the former Soviet Union generally were exposed to. And being Jewish was no benefit in the former Soviet Union. And when Russian Jews came here, some plunged their kids into day school, but the vast majority did not. Of the birthright participants on your trip, how many had similar backgrounds, or were they mostly, you know, American kids going to Israel on a free trip?
Well, I think the miracle of Birthright Israel is that we do things at scale. So every single year we take tens of thousands of participants to Israel, and their knowledge and their experience and their exposure to Judaism varies. So obviously there are those that went to day school, and there are those that never even thought about their Judaism. And on that first trip, I would say that that was true as well, that the range of Jewish experiences and Jewish knowledge varied. But what is really remarkable is that everyone goes through the same experience, and everyone shares this experience in the Jewish state, and they all come out with a pride and a confidence in being part of the Jewish people, and hopefully also responsibility for what it means to be part of the Jewish people as well.
We will talk much more with Elias Saratovsky about Birthright Israel, which direction it's going now in these complicated times, when we come back in a moment here on Too Jewish. Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a wonderful Jewish synagogue in northwest Tucson in the Catalina foothills, celebrates a great array of services, classes, and events this spring. Established by passionate, caring congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha is a vibrant, vital community striving every day to serve God with joy. Progressive congregation in northwest Tucson and the foothills, Beit Simcha is open to everyone throughout the metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services Friday night and Saturday morning, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming. Join us for Shabbat services in person or come on Facebook by going to our website, BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org. We welcome members and guests in person, 520-276-5675. That's 520-276-5675 for more information. Religious school is available for school-age children and grandchildren. Join us in our fabulous Hebrew school, Bar and Bat Mitzvah program, Torah Tykes experience, confirmation and teen programs, now celebrating our fifth year, all in a fun, relaxed setting with great Jewish learning. Go to BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org to sign up. Coming up fast, Sunday, March 24th, Purim for Adults, with nationally renowned comedian Rabbi Bob Alper, 6:30 p.m., a fabulous evening of humor, music, hamantaschen, drinks, and Purim joy. Oh, and some gambling. Beit Simcha services, classes, and events are available to everyone. Friday night, 6:30 p.m., Shabbat evening services with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, and our musicians. Oneg Shabbat, delicious tasting food always follows. Saturday morning, Torah studies at 9 a.m. Shabbat morning services at 10 a.m. All with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, leading them. Facebook page is Beit Simcha Tucson, BeitSimcha Tucson. Our wonderful religious school is available also. For more information about Beit Simcha, to come to services, religious school and Torah Tykes programs, Bar and Bat Mitzvah, confirmation, high school programs, wonderful array of rich adult education academy courses on everything from mysticism to introductory Judaism, all taught live and on Zoom, and all of our services in person and on Facebook, go to BeitSimchaTucson.org or call 520-276-5675. That's 520-276-5675, BeitSimchaTucson.org. Join me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, in the fastest growing Jewish congregation in all of Southern Arizona. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or a criticism, a kvetch or a kvel, please email us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit our website, twojewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through our website, toojewishradio.com, streaming us from there, downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store as podcasts, top 10 in America according to Moment Magazine, over 200,000 downloads on Podbean and on Spotify. Post a rating, review Too Jewish wherever you listen to us. Those comments help. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
There has been a lot of discussion about the danger of violent speech in America, and anti-Semitic speech, for example, calling for the genocide of the Jews, things like that. We should take that very seriously, but America has a very different attitude towards it than many other countries around the world. Where is the balance between free speech and permitting hate speech?
Well, that's a very important question, and it sort of is a natural outgrowth of the subject we raised last week, which is the increase in anti-Semitic rhetoric, anti-Semitic violence, anti-Semitic incidents since October 7th. And there's a concomitant increase, maybe even more dramatic, in the level of Jewish anxiety all over the world.
Right.
There's no country these days where Jews feel
secure,
fully safe. So what's interesting is that Germany, which saw arguably the worst results of anti-Semitic rhetoric and anti-Semitic incidents being tolerated, has very strict laws against hate speech and against anything smacking of neo-Nazi ideology, reviving Hitler's program, whatever. This, like, anybody who comes close to advocating that is like instantly in jail.
Right. Right.
We tend to be the opposite in this country. We so highly prize our freedom of speech and freedom of the press that people can get away with saying and writing almost anything. And this, I think, was one of the issues that Congress had with these university presidents, is they're talking about, we're reluctant to restrict academic freedom and curtail freedom of speech and whatever. And Congress is saying, well, you should muzzle these people. And in a way, although Congress is one of the most American institutions there is, it's very un-American.
Yeah, I mean, it may be un-American, but, you know, what's that old line? My right to say whatever I think ends when I shout fire in a crowded theater. That there are ways in which speech is incredibly powerful and damaging. And look, Judaism believes that speech is, that words created the entirety of the world, right?
It
goes back to the origins of our entire religion and our understanding of things. Terrible speech in which you advocate murder, that I don't know why that's protected speech in America. I understand freedom of speech, being able to say Israel is doing terrible things, to say that Jews have no right to exist, to advocate for genocide. I mean, the worst crime that human beings can conceive of, I think, is probably either torture or genocide. Let's murder an entire people. To be able to advocate for that vocally, as people have done since October 7th, impresses me as not something that a civilized nation should entertain, even in the name of free speech. And obviously Germany agrees with that. Now, whether you think Germany's a civilized nation or not, even in England, where a lot of that goes on, there are limitations. You know, it's much harder to, for example, convict someone of libel in the United States than it is in Great Britain. Lots of other pretty developed countries have come to a different conclusion.
Right.
Where do you think we should be here? I mean, I know Americans think you should be able to say anything you damn well please, but I don't know. Calling for murder of other people?
I think it's an extremely tough question, and to move away from the very neuralgic topic of anti-Semitism and anti-Jewish rhetoric these days to something a little more generic, but you mentioned the old cliche of shouting fire in a crowded theater. Should that be protected speech? I don't think so.
No.
But it's hard to legislate the limits. I mean, you almost have to decide on a case-by-case basis, and in that case, you're deciding after the fact, when a lot of the damage has already been done. So I think it's a huge issue, not only for today, but for the near future, at least for our country, and maybe for other countries in the world as well, is like, where, if, how, when do you draw the line?
It's an important question, and obviously for Jews, very important now, but really important, it depends how important you think speech is. And if you think it matters, then I think it has to be used responsibly. And there'll be a wide definition responsibly. But boy, I tell you, I got to draw the line where you're calling for genocide.
Yep. Speech clearly can be both healing and literally killing.
Tom, thanks so much. We'll talk next week.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. An old Jewish guy is driving down the freeway when all of a sudden the highway patrol officer pulls him over. The officer runs up to the car, motioning frantically for him to lower his window. He screams, "Sir, sir, your wife fell out of the car 5 miles back." The old guy sighs and says, "Oy vey, thank goodness. I thought I'd gone deaf." I know, that was terrible. But it was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well and don't go deaf. And now a word of Torah. This week we finish the book of Exodus with the Torah portion of Pekudei, completing the work and dedication of the tabernacle, the first central place of worship for Jews. The purpose of this shrine is a little unclear initially. After all, if God exists beyond time and space and has no physical manifestation at all, that is, if the Jewish idea of God is right, why does God need any kind of a fixed place of residence? Well, the answer isn't that God needs the tabernacle or the temple in Jerusalem or any sanctuary or chapel or shul of any synagogue or temple anywhere in the world at any time in history. It's we who need that space. Human beings can think abstractly. We can say that we don't need rituals or rites, that we are much too sophisticated to require places for prayer, or even to need to pray at all. We are spiritual, not religious. But when we are alone or in pain, when we are lost, when our minds aren't dulled by texts or television or email or Instagram or social media or the internet or other distractions, we find we still have real needs. And those needs are not abstract, but concrete. We need a place of solace and separation from the outside world, a location where we can seek God and our own best nature in peace and serenity. In short, we modern people still need a temple, just as our ancestors did, for it is there that we will find holiness in a world dedicated to being ordinary. Of course, you can pray anywhere, but having a place of beauty and specific sanctity designed to give tribute to God, that can make all the difference. Think of the difference between a huge office and hotel or residence tower, named for a company or individual to glorify himself or itself, and the sacred spaces constructed to pay tribute to God. Often the spiritual houses are smaller than the financial or hospitality edifices, but they mean so much more. Poet Ruth Brin wrote, "Babel was built to defy deity, to declare the dominion of man. Bricks were passed from hand to hand for a whole year to reach the masons at work on the top of the tower. When a brick fell, they wept. But when a man toppled to his death, they turned their backs. The Tower of Babel was built to glorify man, but achieved degradation and destruction. The sanctuary was built in obedience to God, in recognition of God's dominion. The tent, the sanctuary, proved to be far greater than the tower. Hangings of cloth outlasted brick and mortar. In the ark built to the glory of God, we find our own essential glory, righteousness and holiness, in imitation of God." May our own houses of prayer serve as the great tent in the wilderness did, to deepen our spirit and bring greater meaning to our lives. When we come back in a moment on Too Jewish, our guest, Elias Saratovsky, the executive director of Birthright Israel, explains how important this incredible program is how it has weathered the recent challenges in Israel and emerged more vital than ever. Find out when he joins us in a moment here on Too Jewish.
We continue with our Too Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
Even the UN cannot forever deny the detailed evidence Hamas terrorists raped and committed many acts of depraved sexual violence and torture on Israelis during the October 7th atrocities, although they proved that they could delay any admission of these facts for 5 months. Last week, the United Nations envoy on sex crimes during conflict presented a report at the UN indicating that rape and gang rape likely occurred during the October 7th Hamas onslaught against southern Israel, that clear and convincing evidence shows hostages were raped while being held in Gaza, and that those currently held captive are still facing abuse. The 24-page report, based on more than 2 weeks of meetings on the ground, states that there are reasonable grounds to believe Hamas committed rape and sexual abuse during its murderous, brutal rampage on October 7th, and that there is an even higher standard of evidence to indicate hostages kidnapped by Hamas that day were subjected to rape in captivity. Israel, in response, accused the UN of playing down the report and dragging its feet looking into the allegations, while trying to silence the accusations, something the UN Secretary General denied. Presenting the report at a press conference at UN headquarters in New York, Pramila Patton, the UN Special Representative on Sexual Violence and Conflict, said, "There's clear and convincing information that sexual violence, including rape, sexualized torture, cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment was committed against hostages held in captivity in the Gaza Strip by Hamas." She said there are reasonable grounds to believe that such violence is still ongoing against those hostages still in captivity in Gaza. "The mission was a difficult one in terms of what we heard and the details," said Patton. "We saw a catalog of the most extreme and inhumane forms of torture and other horrors committed by the Arab-Palestinian rapists," she said, noting that her mission was neither intended nor mandated to be investigative in nature. The team said a fully-fledged investigation will be required to establish the overall magnitude, scope, and specific attribution for the sexual violence. Patton visited Israel and the West Bank for 2.5 weeks, met with representatives of 33 Israeli institutions, as well as 34 individuals, including survivors and witnesses, released hostages, first responders, and others. She noted that she did not meet with any survivor of sexual violence because she was told the small number of living survivors are undergoing specialized trauma treatment. They cannot discuss their experiences yet. Her team viewed 5,000 photographs and 50 hours of footage of the attacks. Due to the ongoing conflict, she did not request to visit Gaza. Patton said that based on her evidence gathering, there are reasonable grounds to believe that rape and gang rape occurred, committed by the Palestinian terrorists during the October 7th attacks in at least 3 locations: the Supernova Music Festival site, Kibbutz Re'im, and along Route 232. In most such instances, she said, evidence showed that victims were first subjected to rape and then murdered, noting as well 2 incidents pointing to the rape of women's corpses. The music festival grounds, Patton said, was a site of brutal mass murders, noting that many bodies were found extensively burned or disfigured. There was also a recurring pattern of victims found fully or partially undressed, bound, and shot. In response to the report, Israeli ambassador to the UN, Gilad Erdan, lambasted the international body for taking so long to recognize what happened outside of Gaza. "It took the UN 5 months to finally recognize the horrifying sex crimes that occurred during the Hamas onslaught October 7th, Erdan said. Now that the report of the sexual atrocities and abuse our hostages are going through in Gaza is being released, the shame of the silence of the UN, which is not even holding a single hearing on the issue, cries out to the heavens. Israel has railed at international women's groups that ignored evidence of Hamas's weaponization of sexual violence during the attacks. It took 8 weeks for UN Women, a women's rights group under the tutelage of the UN, to post and shortly thereafter delete a condemnation of October 7th onslaught itself. Another week went by before the agency registered the existence of disturbing reports of gender-based and sexual violence October 7th. The delayed response sparked outrage among Jewish and Israeli feminist groups. The hashtag MeToo, unless you are a Jew, and charging the UN body's silence was motivated by anti-Semitism. Imagine that. The campaign gained traction by December of last year. Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu and United States President Joe Biden publicly castigating international women's groups for ignoring the tremendous mountain of evidence that Hamas used rape as a weapon of war. The New York Times later ran a damning report on the extent of sexual violence during the October 7th attack. And now, only 3 months later, the UN finally came up with a preliminary statement about the atrocity and the vicious sexual violence perpetrated by these Palestinian terrorists. Pathetic and horrible. In Northern California, the violent disruption of an Israeli speaker's appearance on campus last month has triggered bad headlines and a criminal investigation at UC Berkeley. Now, the school is facing a federal discrimination investigation. The U.S. Department of Education announced the investigation into UC Berkeley's handling of anti-Semitism just a week after the incident. That's one of the clearest signs yet the department is moving much faster in responding to campus discrimination claims involving the Israel-Hamas war. The department's Office of Civil Rights announced the Title VI Shared Ancestry investigation at Berkeley, along with four other new investigations to other schools, joining a quickly growing list of discrimination claims since October 7th. The latest investigation, the one at Berkeley, has to do with the events of February 26th. On that day, hundreds of violent anti-Israel protesters on campus forced the cancellation of a planned lecture by Ron Bar Yoshafat, an Israel Defense Force reservist and senior leader of the Kohelet Policy Forum, which backed Israel's judicial, well, coup. The protesters blocked the venue, smashed windows, and physically attacked some students who tried to attend. University police ordered the venue evacuated at the last minute and said they could not guarantee student safety in the riot. The investigation timeline is notable because, although the department has vowed to open every Title VI complaint it receives for investigation, it has typically taken weeks or months for a complaint to trigger a response. The swift action at UC Berkeley comes amid widespread press attention about the incident, which stood out for reports of physical violence. UC Berkeley spokesperson did not elaborate on the investigation, but said they would cooperate fully. The chancellor and provost issued a statement condemning the incident as unacceptable, said some Jewish students experienced overtly anti-Semitic expression. Huh, just some. And the school has opened a criminal investigation. Of the four other new investigations the department announced last week, three of them at Swarthmore College in Pennsylvania, Illinois Wesleyan University, and Middlebury College in Vermont also involve anti-Semitism. Since the October 7th atrocity massacre perpetrated by Hamas, Palestinian civilians who want to escape Gaza to Egypt have found it extremely difficult to do so, as we know. However, according to a report last week, the cost to do so is $6,000 to $7,000 per person, delivered as a bribe to Egyptian border guards. The report says that getting past the Rafah crossing is a desire shared by many Gazan families, for most of them an unattainable fantasy, but some who have gotten to the other side have been Hamas terrorists and their families. Money is not an issue for the terrorist organization. Escapees include nephews and nieces of Hamas murderous leader Yahya Sinwar. The children of Sinwar's sister were smuggled through the Rafah crossing last week. Two children of Hamas police spokesman Ayman al-Batanji also got out. The list also shows the four children of Sama el-Sraj, a member of Hamas's political bureau. The names of senior Hamas official Akili Ahindi and the daughter of a Hamas health minister are also mentioned as having escaped to Egypt. Every few days, more of them get out. Meanwhile, the talks aimed at a ceasefire remain on shaky ground. Israel's agreed to release a number of Palestinian terrorists in exchange for all the remaining Israeli hostages held by Hamas, and to provide a 6-week to 8-week ceasefire. Hamas is insisting on a complete Israeli withdrawal and a permanent ceasefire, a clear non-starter. That means humanitarian aid to solve the famine is also not happening, and the suffering in Gaza thus continues. And that's the two Jewish news of Jews around the world. We welcome back to Two Jewish, the Birthright Israel president, Elias Saratovsky, and CEO of the organization that brings so many young Jews to Israel for what is often their first experience of Israel, a kind of immersive Israel experience in a short term. Birthright Israel has been extraordinarily successful, I think, in connecting young Jews to Israel in a way that wasn't really happening before that. How many, just give us a little bit of a kind of a numbers game, how many people have gone on Birthright Israel since it was founded? How many typically go in a year?
We have been honored to take 850,000 participants from 68 countries over the last 24 years. And just to give you a sense of the magnitude of that number, since our founding, we have taken 25% of all eligible non-Orthodox participants. You know, and to the nature of your question, the ones that are the least affiliated,
right?
We've taken 1 out of 4 eligible Jews to Israel. So when we say that we've impacted a generation of Jews and exposed them to Israel and to their birthright, having a relationship with the Jewish state, those numbers back that up. And the results are off the charts, which I'm sure we can talk about in a little bit.
Birthright Israel, we should explain a little bit. As I recall, you put down a deposit and you got it back when you actually went on the trip. Can you explain the financial commitments that young people make?
For the classic 10-day trip, it's a $360 deposit. And we email you when you complete the trip. And we ask if you'd be willing to contribute your deposit to allow someone else to go. And a significant percentage of the participants contribute their deposit to pay the gift forward. And we are exploring ways to increase that percentage. Right now, about a third of the participants contribute their deposit. And for the onward trip, again, the longer, more immersive trips, participants pay for their airfare, and they also pay a deposit as well.
Now, that $360 deposit is a small percentage of the actual cost of the trip, right?
Correct. Yeah. So it costs a lot of money to send tens of thousands of participants.
Yeah, I was just in Israel, so I know it's not an inexpensive proposition.
Now, look, for the 10-day trip, the cost to send one participant to Israel is $4,500.
Wow.
That includes the airfare, their ground transportation, their hotel costs. So it's an incredible investment, and I would challenge anyone to plan any 10-day trip anywhere for only $4,500. So we do it with economies of scale and keeping costs down without compromising the experience. But if you multiply that by 30,000 participants, it's a lot of money, and we are very honored to have many, many donors across the country. We have 30,000 people who contribute to our work on an annual basis. People who contribute as little as $10, to people who contribute as much as $10 million a year, and everyone in between. And part of the job that we are honored to do is to work with our donors across the country, both with individuals, with family foundations, with philanthropists, and get more people involved, because we believe that Birthright Israel is a gift to the Jewish people, but it's really something that we should continue to invest in to make sure that gift is passed down from generation to generation.
So tell us a little bit about these Onward programs, because I don't think people are as familiar with that.
Sure. Onward is a incredible program that was founded by two individuals from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, Cindy and David Shapiro, who had this idea that, you know, young people care deeply about their professional internship opportunities, and more they're traveling across the world, obviously across the United States, but also to places like London and Berlin to have internship opportunities. And Cindy and David Shapiro said, well, why not Israel? Why can't Israel be a place where young Jews go to intern over the summer? So they created a program called Onward Israel to provide young people with an opportunity to both intern in Israel, but also to experience Israel over the summer, to have a much longer, more immersive experience in Israel. And in 2021, Onward and Birthright merged to take the best of both of our organizations and to expand Onward. And it's been a remarkable relationship that we've continued to grow. And the volunteer program that we launched in November 2023, literally in the shadow of the war, was done through Onward. And it was just a great example of how we can take the best of Birthright Israel, bringing transformative experiences in Israel, and putting it on a platform through Onward that knows how to do much more longer, more immersive opportunities and experiences.
So a final question, what kinds of innovative programming do you see that would be different going forward for Birthright Israel?
Yeah, it's a great question. So if you think about what is our real vision, right? We want to build a more vibrant Jewish future through connecting young people to the land of Israel, to the Jewish people, and ultimately to build a future where we are proud and confident to be Jews in this very complicated world. And we've had remarkable success through this 10-day program that will continue to be the hallmark of our work. But we're constantly looking for other transformative, immersive experiences in Israel. There is a program that we are piloting now called Career Passport. This is targeting young people who are digital nomads, who have jobs where they can work from anywhere. This program allows young people to spend several weeks living in Israel, doing their job from Israel, and experiencing Israel with other Jews who are going through similar, you know, kind of digital nomadic experiences. Because if they can do their job from New York or San Francisco, they may as well do it from Tel Aviv for a period of time and have that experience together in Israel. We are looking at ways to deepen the connection to Israel with Jewish professionals. You know, one of the things that we're very proud of is that there was a study done by an organization called Leading Edge a few years ago that surveyed thousands of Jewish professionals across the country. And they found that 75% of Jewish professionals under the age of 40 went on a Birthright trip. And for many of them, that was the spark to their Jewish identity, like myself, that led to their career in the Jewish community. One of the other innovative programs that we have been working on that unfortunately was delayed as a result of the current war is a program specifically targeting Jewish professionals for them to go to Israel together for a month to deepen their connection and their commitment to Israel and to each other. Yeah, because we know that it's the Jewish professionals across this country, whether it's the rabbis or the Hillel professionals or the JCC professionals, they are the engine that make our community run. And we believe that Birthright Israel has a role in strengthening their connection to Israel and to each other. That's one of the other programs we're working on. But, you know, the reality is that we're constantly thinking of new programs and new innovative ways to build a brighter Jewish future for the entire community.
I want to thank Elias Saratovsky for a great visit here on Too Jewish. Where can people go to find out more about Birthright Israel?
They can go to birthrightisrael.com to apply for a trip. I encourage everyone between the ages of 18 and 40 to apply for a volunteer opportunity. If you're between the ages of 18 and 26 and are eligible to apply for a 10-day trip, we know how to run safe, meaningful trips, even during a time of war. We've done it before, and we're very, very proud to do it right now. And if you're interested in funding our work, I would go to birthrightisrael.foundation, which is our website. where you can learn more about our work and invest in transforming Jewish lives now and into the future.
Thank you so much, Elias, and continued success. I think it's a great program, and I'm glad that it's not being put off too much by the war and the creativity you guys are showing. Thank you again.
Thank you. Thank you for this time, and it was great to talk to you.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out.
The stories we share last a lifetime and are passed down from generation to generation, known for our compassionate commitment to the families we serve. Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has faithfully served the Tucson community and the Jewish community for over 100 years. We help thousands of families plan and carry out celebrations of loved ones in unique and special ways and assist them in sharing those lifetimes of stories meaningfully. The most beautiful and tranquil final resting place in all of southern Arizona, Evergreen's tall pines shade peaceful grassy fields. You can count on Evergreen for superior service and the highest degree of integrity. Our informative, well-trained staff is here to assist you with a full range of on-site services. Call Evergreen. 520-888-7470, 520-888-7470. While we serve the whole community, our experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. We have sections dedicated to all religious faiths, can help you arrange for your future needs or your immediate ones. Whether you choose to hold a traditional funeral service or a completely individualized ceremony, either in person or online or both, our goal is to help you create a meaningful, personalized service based upon your unique needs in a place of reflection, tradition, and serenity. Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best to the community and to you. Call 520-888-7470. To speak to a family advisor at Evergreen, call 520-888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next week. Our guest will be Rabbi Bob Alper, comedian extraordinaire and headliner at the upcoming Purim for Grownups celebration on the 24th of this month at Congregation Beit Simcha. And come to Beit Simcha every Friday night. Services in Oneg Shabbat, 6:30 p.m., Saturday morning, 2, 9 a.m. Torah study, 10 a.m. services, Torah reading and Kiddush in person and on Facebook. Sign up for Purim for Grownups. Go to BeitSimchaTucson.org for more information. Our playout is for the upcoming holiday of Purim, just 2 weeks away, from the wonderful Sephardic group Voice of the Turtle, their Purim album Sword of the Dove, the song Kichlot Yeni, Drink Wine, Not Water, on Purim. My friends, have a Shavua Tov, a Chodesh Tov, a good new month, a good week, a healthy week, a week we pray profoundly of peace.
Sponsored by Two Jewish Radio Programs, Tucson, Arizona.